This is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thanks for tuning in. On today's program, we will feature pieces from the BBC, the Disability Scoop, the Braille Monitor, as well as a number of other publications. We'll begin the program with that piece from the BBC. It's entitled, Disabled Explorer Begins South Pole Solo Ski, by Georgina Barnes. A former GB para-athlete has set off to become the first disabled person to ski solo and unsupported to the South Pole. Johnny Huntington, 38, from Kingsbridge, South Devon, suffered a stroke while serving as an officer in the British Army in 2014. It left him completely paralyzed from the neck down on his left side. After a decade of rehabilitation and training, he began his challenge of skiing 566 miles, that's 911 kilometers, of Antarctic tundra on Monday, an expedition he said would take 40 days. Mr. Huntington said the attempt would be quite exciting, as no one with a disability has done this before. Ultimate test. Mr. Huntington experienced left side paralysis following his stroke and has a significant lack of strength, mobility, and control down that side. During his recovery, he became a member of the Armed Forces Para Snow Sport Team and competed for the GB Para Nordic Ski Team from 2017 to 2020 at World Cups in Ukraine and Finland. The idea for his South Pole expedition was planted after he stopped skiing competitively. He said, I'll be doing it completely on my own with no sort of help, no resupply, nothing like that. Existing somewhere which is fundamentally hostile to life, it's the ultimate test. Mr. Huntington is dragging all his equipment and food in a sled weighing about 110 kilograms, 242 pounds. To prepare, he also undertook a 20-day solo expedition in northern Sweden in April. Mr. Huntington has flown into Union Glacier to spend a few days on the ice for final preparations before setting out from Fuchs Messner on the edge of the Antarctic landmass on 21 November. He said he was confident he had done the right level of preparation to complete the attempt. I've done everything I can to make it succeed, but I've never been to Antarctica before. It famously has quite strict conditions down there. There aren't disabled explorers. It's not a job, but I'll just have to figure out how we can make this work. Our next piece comes from the Redstone Rocket. It's entitled, NASA Spreads Awareness for Disability Employment, by Serena Whitfield, at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. In conjunction with National Disability Employment Awareness Month, Marshall Space Flight Center held an agency-wide virtual event held by the Office of Diversity and Equal Opportunity on October 24th. Marshall team members watched the WebEx event in Building 4221. In alignment with the month's national theme, Access to Good Jobs for All, the program highlighted the perspectives of people with disabilities in the workplace as they navigate the work life cycle, from applying to onboarding, career growth and advancement, and day-to-day engagements. The event began with Marshall Associate Director Roger Baird welcoming NASA team members. NASA is dedicated to inclusive hiring practices and providing pathways for good jobs and career success for all employees, including workers with disabilities, Baird said. Some ways we do this is through targeted recruitment of qualified individuals with disabilities through accessible vacancy announcements, outreach to students with disabilities, and community partnerships. NASA also utilizes Schedule A authority, a non-competitive direct hiring authority to hire people with disabilities without competition. Baird introduced event moderator Joyce Mayer, logistics manager at Marshall, who welcomed panelists Casey Denham, Kathy Clark, Paul Spahn, and Paul Sullivan, all NASA team members. The panelists from the disability community discussed their work life cycles, lessons learned in the workplace, and shared a demonstration of colorblindness and its impact. Denham discussed some of the best practices for onboarding employees with neurodiversity, a term used to describe people whose brains develop or work differently than the typical brain. Clark talked about what can be done to continue raising awareness and advocating for disability rights. She said, NASA empowers its workforce with knowledge so they can be informed allies to team members with disabilities and foster a safe and inclusive working environment. Spahn gave insight into practical steps employers can take to accommodate candidates with deafness, and Sullivan spoke about some key considerations NASA managers should keep in mind to make the job application process more accessible to candidates with low vision. Guest speaker Chip Dobbs, supply management specialist at Marshall, talked about his personal experience with being deaf. Dobbs has worked at NASA for 29 years and said he has never let his disability hold him back, but instead uses it as a gateway to inspire and connect with others. The event ended with closing remarks from Tora Henry, Director of the Office of Diversity and Equal Opportunity at Marshall. The virtual event placed importance on planning for NASA's future by promoting equality and addressing the barriers people with disabilities face in the workplace. As we celebrate National Disability Employment Awareness Month, keep in mind that NASA's mission of exploring the unknown and pushing the boundaries of human potential requires the contributions of every mind, skill set, and perspective, Baird said. Our commitment to inclusivity ensures that no talent goes untapped and no idea goes unheard, because together, we're not just reaching for the stars, we're showing the world what's possible when everyone has a seat at the table. And now, a piece from Travel and Leisure. The title? This iconic destination was just named the most accessible city in Europe. Paris is the most accessible city in Europe for travelers with disabilities. By Stacy Liska. Traveling is a right held by everyone. Seeing the world, experiencing new things, trying new foods, and making friends all over the globe is something everyone should be able to do, including those living with a disability. If we're honest, not everywhere is easy to navigate in a wheelchair, with a cane, or if you need to move slower than the rest of the traffic. However, there are a few destinations that rise above the rest for their ultra accessibility. In October, Good to Go, a specialist travel insurance provider, released its findings analyzing which of the most popular travel destinations are the best for older or disabled travelers. To find out which places are the most accessible, the team first created a seed list of the top 20 European cities based on the number of annual visitors to each. It then measured each destination across multiple points, including forms of public transport, healthcare, and accessible restaurants, tourist attractions. Some data points were calculated per 100,000 people to avoid larger cities ranking higher unfairly. After looking at all the numbers, the team named Paris the most accessible city in Europe. Scoring highly across the board, Paris was revealed as the number one destination, the company shared in an announcement shared with Travel and Leisure. The City of Lights ranked in the top five cities across all metrics other than the number of forms of public transport and the number of accessible attractions. Three Italian cities, Milan, Florence, and Venice, ranked among the top five destinations, third to fifth, respectively. Florence also snagged the top spot for both accessible attractions and accessible restaurants. However, as the findings noted, Florence and Venice rank among the bottom cities for available forms of public transport. Perhaps rather surprisingly to anyone who has ever been, Lisbon was named the second most accessible. Though it's famed for its hills and its cobblestone streets, Lisbon ranked highly for its number of transportation options, accessible cultural sites, and healthcare. As a resident of Lisbon, I suggest hiring one of the plentiful tuk-tuk drivers to take you around the entire city, or hop on a tram to see and do it all without having to worry about its elevation gains. Also making an appearance in the top 10 is Athens in 6th, followed by Amsterdam, Prague, Munich, and Berlin. Understandably, for many people living with disabilities, medical conditions, or mobility issues, going abroad to an unfamiliar location can be off-putting, Grant Winter, compliance officer at Good to Go, said. There are often concerns about leaving an established support network, being able to get around a new city, and what might happen if you need medical attention. The good news is that travel is becoming increasingly accessible, with many world-class must-see locations being extremely accessible and easy to navigate. Our research found that several of the world's most iconic cultural cities are also some of the most accessible, meaning that these destinations offer the perfect travel opportunities for everyone, regardless of age or disability. This next story comes from the United States Census Bureau. New report on U.S. veterans and service-connected disabilities. This is a press release from the Census Bureau. November 6, 2024. The share of U.S. veterans with service-connected disabilities increased from 15% in 2008 to about 30% in 2022, according to a new report released today by the U.S. Census Bureau. The report, Trends in Veteran Disability Status and Service-Connected Disability, 2008 to 2022, investigates disability among veterans of the U.S. Armed Forces and how they compared to the broader non-veteran population. It focuses on disability rates among post-9/11 veterans, those who have served since September 2001. Post-9/11 veterans are the nation's youngest cohort of veterans and have been at the forefront of recent veteran public health research. Other highlights. The share of veterans with neither a service-connected disability nor another type of disability defined by the American Community Survey, ACS, decreased from 65% in 2008 to about 52% in 2022. After accounting for the demographic and socioeconomic characteristics of veterans, the chance of post-9/11 veterans having a service-connected disability increased from about 18% in 2008 to 31% in 2022. In 2022, post-9/11 veterans were more likely to have a cognitive disability, 8.9%, than other veterans, 4.8%, or non-veterans, 3.8%, after accounting for the demographic and socioeconomic characteristics of these groups. Post-9/11 veterans in 2022 were more likely to report a high service-connected disability rating. Those with a service-connected disability had a 50% chance of reporting a high service-connected disability rating, 70% or greater, up from 27% in 2008. This report is based on 2008 to 2019 and 2021 to 2022 ACS one-year estimates. The Census Bureau did not release its standard 2020 ACS data due to the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, so data from 2020 were not included in this analysis. This next article comes from the New York Times. It's entitled, American Sign Language Brings New Layers to American Idiot. Performed simultaneously in sign language and sung English, a Los Angeles revival of the Green Day musical finds new ways to communicate rage and angst. By Gabe Cohn. Inside the Mark Taper Forum in downtown Los Angeles on a recent Wednesday, the air was saturated with stage fog and pre-show jitters. The first performance of a revival of Green Day's American Idiot was just hours away, and the choreographer, Jennifer Weber, had some final instructions for the cast members who were wearing their costumes. Combat boots, eyeliner, enough artfully ripped jeans to fill a hot topic, while they ran through dance movements on stage. Weber, microphone in hand, sang the song Homecoming as she demonstrated choreography. What the hell's your name? What's your pleasure? What is your pain? An American Sign Language interpreter, Maria Cardoza, stood alongside the actors, signing Weber's directions. At one point, Colin Analco, the show's ASL choreographer, was slipped a small flashlight to illuminate Cardoza's signing motions under the din of the fog and ambient lights. Weber kept singing, then started counting the beats. Blew his brains out. 1, 2, 3. Around the theater, about a dozen other conversations, some in spoken English and some in sign language, were happening among the cast and crew. Their show is the latest interpretation of a set of songs that have had many lives. After all, American Idiot is many things. It's an album that monopolized alternative radio in 2004, but also a present-day staple of nostalgic streaming playlists. It's a time capsule of Iraq War-era political disillusionment and a distillation of timeless teenage angst. A musical adaptation of the album debuted in 2009 and made its way to Broadway in 2010. Now, this revival of that show is proving with gusto that American Idiot can be yet another thing. A near-scientific study of the innumerable ways to give somebody the finger. Or at least how many different ways the human body can be used to convey the emotions behind a raised middle finger. The production, which opened October 9th and is running through November 16th, is a collaboration between the nonprofit Center Theater Group and Deaf West Theater, a Tony Award-winning company that stages plays and musicals that blend American Sign Language with spoken English. The cast includes both deaf and hearing performers. Certain lead characters are played by two people at once, one deaf actor who primarily communicates using sign language, and one hearing actor who sings and talks in spoken English. It's a well-established method for producing work for audiences of deaf and hearing people. Deaf West has specialized in it for decades, but, as one might expect, American Idiot, a fast-paced, loud pop-punk musical filled with wordplay, alienation, for instance, and four-letter words, presented the artists with some novel challenges. An idiosyncratic musical. Built around rock songs that were not written for the stage, among them Boulevard of Broken Dreams, Wake Me Up When September Ends, and the title track, the American Idiot musical is almost entirely sung through with little dialogue. Its book was written by Green Day's frontman, Billy Joe Armstrong, and the Broadway director, Michael Mayer. Its story, about three teenage misfits named Johnny, Will, and Tunny, whose lives diverge, is primarily conveyed through the staging. When DJ Kurz, the artistic director of Deaf West, was approached by Snehal Desai, the show's director and the artistic director of Center Theater Group, about collaborating on a sung, signed revival, the first response was fear, Kurz said. Like several other interviews conducted for this article, the conversation with Kurz, who is deaf, was facilitated by a sign language interpreter. A primary concern, Kurz explained, was that incorporating deafness into characters who communicate through snarling punk songs would play into the stereotype that deaf people are always angry at the hearing world, he said. On the other hand, it had the potential to play against some stereotypes, especially, he added, pop culture's spotty at best track record of presenting multi-dimensional deaf characters. For example, a 2022 study co-written by Kurz found that 70% of deaf consumers said deaf characters on TV and film were often presented as objects of pity. Things are different with the head-banging assertive roles here. Daniel Durant, a star of the 2022 film Coda and Deaf West's 2015 Broadway revival of Spring Awakening, a deaf actor who performs the role of Johnny alongside Milo Mannheim, a hearing actor, said that Johnny, a self-described son of rage and love, is the most rebellious and the most anti-establishment character that I've ever played. The punk-spewing central characters aren't seeking pity, Durant said. We just rage together, Mannheim added later. We let our rage out. They usually let it out, at least. Some situations call for holding it in and buttoning it up. Landon Gonzalez, a deaf actor who plays Tunney, discussed how he shifts his signing style when he's signing as Tunney, who joins the military. I like to make jokes. I like to play with people and just kind of be that jokester in the room, Gonzalez says of his typical way of signing. But my character, you have to sign a little bit more firmly. New territory for Deaf West. Weber, who was brought on as the show's dance choreographer, said the team had an important question to puzzle out. What does it mean to be physically loud? Because ASL is not sonic, right? So how do you create loud visuals? One strategy was to choreograph abrupt physical shifts. If you have a moment on stage where people are doing different things and then everyone is suddenly in unison, that feels louder, she said. Another technique was what Weber described as on-stage multiplication. Having a move begin with a single performer, then be repeated by an increasing number of dancers. We physically echo, she said. On-stage captions also help. Putting most subtitles to shame, the captions in This American Idiot, prominently and clearly displayed at every performance, are packed with visual flair reflecting the tones of the songs. Words literally shake with intensity. Typefaces get wild. Projected letters stretch and drip down the set as characters get high. It's important to note that these characters are not simply all hearing characters whose lines are expressed through sign language. In this production, many characters, including the story's three central friends, are portrayed as deaf themselves. This gave cast members who are deaf some extra room to introduce that aspect of their perspectives into source material written by hearing artists. Not that the original script didn't give the team plenty to chew on. The blistering source material introduced its own set of hurdles for Analco, the ASL choreographer. He took the lead on translating every song into sign language, working with Weber to fuse the signing movement and dance choreography. When we think about punk rock, it's very edgy, it's dangerous, it brings elements of risk, he said. No pure translation is ever possible, which is both a challenge and an artistic opportunity. As Analco put it, how do we create the intention and evoke the same type of feeling that the hearing audience is getting from listening to the lyrics? One of the trickiest lyrics came midway through the number Holiday, an anti-authoritarian anthem that manages to turn the line, I beg to dream and differ from the hollow lies, into a catchy hook. On the original recording, Armstrong shifts into a voice dripping with mockery as he sings Sieg Heil to the President Gas Man. For obvious reasons, it's language that needs a particular kind of sarcastic, sneering delivery to work. So Analco worked that into the ASL translation, blending two opposing signs, one that is an expression of honor, another a rough equivalent to saying, take a hike. The result is tonally similar to saluting somebody while giving them the middle finger. Cue the lights and light the cues. Several cast members take advantage of an elaborate system of colored lights, visible to the performers and manually controlled from off stage, that gives cues for when certain actions need to be performed or sung lines signed. These are used alongside subtle physical cues by actors, both hearing and deaf, that allow the cast to stay in sync. During shows, the cue lights, which hang above the seats, are blocked from the audience's view. During another recent rehearsal, this one after preview performances had begun, a crew member, Abby Peterson, demonstrated how the lights worked. Peterson was seated at a table off stage right, hovering over a rectangular black box covered in chunky metal switches that would have not looked out of place in the cockpit of a jet. Each switch corresponded to a colored cue light, and each actor who relied on the system had been assigned a unique color. As it happened, that day, an additional actor was being added to the system. The actor had been relying on a cochlear implant, and the device had broken. The culprit was thought to be sweat. The cue light system would help compensate. Also on the desk was a tablet computer displaying sheet music that had been marked up with color-coded lines indicating when each switch was to be flicked on or off. When the light changed, that was the actor's cue. Peterson pointed out Durant's color, blue. At that moment, Durant was on stage wearing his costume of plaid, denim, and Converse. He and other cast members were finessing moments in St. Jimmy, a particularly raucous number. The song's energy called to mind something Durant had said earlier about his relationship to music. Growing up, he reflected, I didn't enjoy or even experience music as a profoundly deaf person. But one thing I've always enjoyed is rhythm. I love a pounding bass. I love the throb. It could be a ticking clock. It could be a heartbeat. It could be the rhythm of a person's breath. Those are all beats in our lives. This show, he went on to say, is rock and punk. It's heavy bass. When the audience members arrived that night, they might have noticed that there is no pre-show playlist, no music in the theater before this performance. Instead, as people take their seats, something else is played out of the speakers, the low, percussive thumps of a beating heart. You are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. And now a piece from the Braille Monitor entitled So Much Regulation, So Little Change by Peter Slayton from the editor. It is interesting and sometimes difficult to understand the background of our laws here in the United States, let alone comparing and contrasting them with laws in other countries. Our author does a good job of describing the history of laws here and in Canada, complete with their difference in emphasis and their pros and cons. Peter is a consultant, writer, and disability advocate. He lives in New York City and is the founder of the Slayton Group, created in 2012. He also serves as a board member of the Colorado Center for the Blind. A version of this article appeared in the September issue of Able News. In late May, I participated in Accessible Canada, Accessible World, a two-day conference in Montreal created by the International Design Resource Center at the Ontario College of Art and Design and sponsored by Accessibility Standards Canada, a federal agency tasked with developing what its name calls for. It was an extraordinary event, with most discussions held in a flipped classroom format. Two people in the somewhat interchangeable roles of facilitator and provocateur guided attendees, most of whom were accessibility and disability scholars and advocates, in discussion while encouraging everyone present in person or virtually to contribute. Not surprisingly, the majority of attendees were Canadian, and the majority of discussions were framed around accessibility creation in Canada. I suddenly found myself outside of what I realized was my U.S.-centric disability and accessibility comfort zone. The ACAW event allowed me to see how the different approaches to enabling and optimizing disability inclusion of a nation that is our very close geographic and cultural neighbor can highlight both positives and negatives in our own journey toward full accessibility. We pride ourselves here on having enshrined disability rights in law with the passage and signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act 34 years ago. Yet, in Canada, the rights of people with disabilities are foundational. They are written into its 1982 Constitution. That's as basic as it gets. Yet, against the background of the long-running failure of the United States to pass the Equal Rights Amendment for women to our Constitution, it's difficult to expect that an equivalent amendment guaranteeing equal rights to disabled people would get very far. Even if it did, would it make it easier to increase the prevalence and quality of accommodations across society? If Canada's history is any guide, apparently not much. So activists kept pushing, and 37 years after the Constitution was adopted, the Accessible Canada Act, ACA, became law. The ACA, like the ADA, is a federal statute, but unlike the ADA, it seeks to regulate only federal entities and federally regulated business enterprises, including banking, telecom, transportation, and federal services. In contrast, the ADA seeks to regulate private enterprise as well as government at the federal, state, and local level, including education and employment. State laws offering stronger protections than the ADA override it, and vice versa. Canada's provinces, territories, and local governments are not under the ACA's jurisdiction, although they can pass their own regulations. The strongest of these is the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, the AODA, passed in 2005, which some provinces and territories have used as a partial template. The development and passage of both the ADA and ACA were driven by activists, and each reflects a seemingly robust mechanism for embedding accessibility into their respective national landscapes. But that outcome is proving illusory. The ADA is overseen by the U.S. Department of Justice. It's not exactly written in stone, but other than through litigation, there is no formalized process for reviewing, revising, and updating the statute. The Canadian Federal Department, Accessibility Standards Canada, was created through the ACA and is a framework for collecting and reviewing input from stakeholders across the diverse disability community to design, set, and implement accessibility standards. In simpler terms, the ADA is a reactive mechanism permitting government to rely on the disappointment and anger of citizens at the ongoing failures of private and public sector enterprises to acknowledge and act on the need for change. The ACA offers a proactive and collaborative approach to maintain a living legislative framework that theoretically gives citizens with disabilities the means to establish and strengthen the legislation. Yet, in their enforcement mechanisms, these two approaches also reflect each nation's disinterested attitude toward a full-throated embrace of accessibility. The ADA invites, insists on, litigation, guaranteeing the entrenchment of adversarial attitudes towards disability inclusion. For its part, the ACA kindly requests and hopes that everyone will do the right thing. While it includes a procedure for processing complaints and even for asking entities to respond and comply or face fines, the actual mechanisms for doing so are buried in time, a consuming and tedious bureaucracy, a less than robust formula for successful remediation. Despite enormous efforts on every front, and despite the plethora of regulation that has been enacted toward the creation of accessible societies, the movement continues to grind against the same basic entrenched barriers: public, business, and governmental indifference. Perhaps as the developed world ages and finds itself understanding accessibility as a personal need that might have something to do with how everyone else also functions, societal attitudes will recognize and accommodate to reality. Next up is another piece from the Braille Monitor, this one entitled "The Sugar" by Anil Lewis. From the Associate Editor. Anil Lewis is a former affiliate and chapter president, among many other roles, and currently the executive director for Blindness Initiatives on the National Federation of the Blind staff. I remember growing up and hearing many of my family members and their friends consistently referring to an affliction they were experiencing called the sugar. Did you hear that Mary has the sugar? I had no idea what it meant and was definitely not threatened. How bad could it be? After all, like bacon, sugar makes everything delicious. Recently diagnosed as a diabetic, I have come to know the sugar as diabetes and realized the significant threat that it poses to my life and, according to the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, 38.4 million other Americans. Thankfully, this is another issue that the National Federation of the Blind works to address head-on. Diabetes is a disease that occurs when your blood glucose, also called blood sugar, is too high. Glucose is your body's main source of energy. Your body can make glucose, but glucose also comes from the food you eat. Over time, high blood glucose can damage your heart, kidneys, feet, and eyes. Many members of the National Federation of the Blind are very familiar with diabetes because one of the potential negative health effects of the disease is diabetic retinopathy, which is a progressive eye condition where the blood vessels around the retina get progressively damaged by high blood sugar levels and is the top cause of blindness among working-age adults. Interestingly enough, with my mother, aunt, uncles, siblings, cousins, and other family members experiencing diabetes, I did not come to know blindness because of diabetes. I became blind due to retinitis pigmentosa at the age of 25, with no other health complications, and paid no attention to the fact that I was at high risk for diabetes. Moreover, despite years of warnings from my primary care physician about being borderline diabetic, I still took no steps to alter my eating or exercise habits. For those currently exercising the same strategy of inaction, I offer the following. Ignoring health concerns is not a good strategy for prevention. Additionally, I ignored common symptoms of diabetes. I appreciated the weight loss and attributed it to better living. The constant need to urinate just became part of my day-to-day life. Ignorance was only bliss for a little while. Around age 55, I finally crossed the borderline and became an official type 2 diabetic. The actual diagnosis was intimidating. I had so many questions. How would this change my life? What would I need to stop eating? Would I need to have insulin injections? Most importantly, would I need to give up chocolate? An additionally disturbing potential consequence of diabetes is diabetic neuropathy. nerve damage that is caused by diabetes that, in the case of peripheral neuropathy, typically affects the feet and legs and sometimes affects the arms and hands. Diabetic neuropathy can be doubly damaging for blind people, as the loss of eyesight can also be complicated by the loss of sensitivity in the hands and feet, making it difficult for a blind person to read Braille or gain access to environmental information tactilely through their hands and feet. Now, I realized why I had the tingling in my feet at night, which was scary because I had friends who had toes and other body parts amputated as a result of their diabetes. Thankfully, my diabetes can currently be treated with oral medication, but I realize that I am at another borderline, and unless I make some significant lifestyle changes, diabetes could lead to so many other health complications. My overachieving Air Force colonel, trauma surgeon, ordained minister cousin made it plain when he told me that you don't know the damage diabetes is doing to your body until the damage has been done. Finally, realizing that this is a serious health concern that I should address immediately, I began making better decisions on what to eat and started a simple exercise routine. My cousin emphasized the importance of changing my diet and increasing my exercise. He also explained that working out the larger muscles burn more sugar, so I added squats, lunges, and push-ups to my workout. I do not mean to infer that this is simple and that I consistently adhere to a new diet and exercise regularly. It is difficult and takes work. I still cheat a little when there is a delicious chocolate cake on the menu, and I still miss a few days of my morning exercises. However, I am dedicated to continuing moving in a positive direction toward making these changes, and I take 3 steps forward for every 1 or 2 steps backward. It is somewhat advantageous that blindness came before diabetes. Otherwise, I may not have become aware of my greatest resource, the NFB Diabetes Action Network, that DAN. The DAN is one of the many affinity groups of the NFB made up of blind diabetics that, through our collective action and a shared life experience, provide information and support to one another, seek to promote systemic change to improve the lives of blind people, collaborate with technology developers to innovate dynamic means for blind people to access information, and in this particular case, strive to work with medical professionals to ensure that those individuals who experience blindness as a result of diabetes realize that they can still live the lives they want. Members of the DAN have assisted me by sharing suggestions on healthy snacks that would replace my sugar-filled favorites and are equally delicious. Our conversations about accessible ways to monitor glucose initially helped me understand how to use an accessible glucometer and have evolved to my current use of a glucose sensor that monitors my glucose throughout the day and is accessed using a smartphone app. I can better understand the meaning of A1C as a result of common sense discussions with others. I strongly encourage all blind diabetics to join this dynamic division. DAN members have done some initial work of assisting to develop accessible insulin pumps by engaging with several manufacturers through the creation of our Accessible Insulin Pump Task Force, and we will be expanding that work through our new Accessible Diabetes Device Work Group. We believe this work will eventually lead to the development of an accessible bionic pancreas and will support our Medical Device Non-Visual Accessibility Act legislative efforts, because there is definitely a link between legislation and progress, and the reverse of that, progress leading to legislation. Our participation in these initiatives will not only result in the development of medical devices that are non-visually accessible to blind users, it will result in the creation of multimodal devices that are easier and safer for everyone to use. We believe that by bringing blind people, medical professionals, technology developers, and medical device manufacturers together, we can build on our collective knowledge toward creating enhanced treatment strategies that will result in improved quality of life for all. Our first Knowledge is Sweet conference held earlier this year educated, entertained, and inspired others to take control of their diabetes and was a successful start to what we hope to be an ongoing annual conference. We are already making plans for our 2025 conference that will be held at the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute on a date to be announced. The National Federation of the Blind continues to assert that blind people have the right to live in the world. The work we conduct through our NFB Diabetes Action Network actively seeks to bring awareness of the intersection of blindness and diabetes and highlights how society can be improved through our full participation. We are happy to recognize November as National Diabetes Awareness Month and celebrate November 14 as National Diabetes Day. Whether you are blind or sighted, you can take steps to prevent acquiring diabetes. If you have diabetes, you can lower your chances of developing diabetes health problems by taking steps to improve your health and learning how to manage the disease. Managing your blood glucose, blood pressure, and cholesterol levels can help prevent future health problems. Most importantly, if you are blind and have diabetes, remember that you can live the life you want. Neither blindness nor diabetes holds you back. Our next piece is from the Disability Scoop. It's entitled, What Trump's Win Could Mean for Medicaid Disability Programs, by Michelle Diament. With former President Donald Trump returning to the White House, advocates say that they are bracing for his administration to push major changes to Medicaid and other programs that people with disabilities rely on. Trump reclaimed the presidency this week after defeating Vice President Kamala Harris. While the campaign largely steered clear of disability issues, advocates say that Trump's record during his first term offers reason for worry. Based on actions taken during the first Trump administration, we are concerned with what the election will mean to the funding and structure of many important programs for people with disabilities, like Medicaid, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act funding, enforcement of civil rights laws, among others, said Eric Buhlman, Deputy Executive Director for Public Policy at the National Disability Rights Network. Efforts to radically restructure Medicaid and pay for tax cuts for corporations by cutting other programs are things we saw last time and expect to be tried again. Many of these types of policy changes are echoed in Project 2025, a 900-page conservative playbook from the Heritage Foundation. Though Trump has distanced himself from the plan, it is widely viewed as a possible blueprint for his second term. Before this week's election, the Consortium for Constituents with Disabilities, a coalition of national disability organizations, was raising alarm bells about Project 2025. The group called out proposals to restructure Medicaid and impose lifetime eligibility limits on the government health program, as well as sweeping changes to the way that special education is funded, a plan to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education, and measures that they say would weaken civil rights protections for people with disabilities. People with disabilities need strong federal laws, policies, and programs that take their needs and aspirations into account, reads a statement about Project 2025 from the Consortium for Constituents with Disabilities. The Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 plan would eviscerate these standards and push disabled people back to an earlier, shameful era of isolation, exclusion, and institutionalization. Kim Machino, Vice President of Public Policy at the Autism Society of America, said her group is particularly worried about any move the new administration might take to retool healthcare policies that benefit people with disabilities. The Affordable Care Act has been life-changing for everyone, especially those with pre-existing conditions, such as autism. Medicaid is literally a lifeline for people with disabilities who depend on home and community-based supports to be able to live with their families, work in the community, and stay out of more expensive institutions, she said. We fought back attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act and proposals to cut Medicaid before. If similar proposals come forward in the new Congress, we will be ready to defend them again. Meanwhile, Zoe Gross, Director of Advocacy at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, said advocates are also concerned about the possibility of the government circulating misinformation about autism and vaccines. Trump has reportedly promised a role in his administration to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has spent years speaking out about a link between the two, despite studies finding no connection. During the campaign, Trump faced backlash from disability advocates and members of both political parties for referring to Harris as mentally impaired and mentally disabled. In addition, Trump's nephew, Fred C. Trump III, alleged that the former president told him that people like his son, who has intellectual and developmental disabilities, should just die. Nonetheless, Maria Town, president and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities, said she's optimistic that it will be possible to find common ground. Regardless of who won, many disabled people have long felt that Social Security and Medicaid's current levels of function have left a lot to be desired. It's possible that Trump will be open to some of the changes the community has hoped for in those programs, she said. We hope we all are able to move forward and turn a new leaf to create the most positive working environment possible. And now, also from the Disability Scoop, this piece entitled PBS Kids Show to Feature Main Characters with Autism by Michelle Diament. In a first, a new PBS Kids show showcasing a cast of neurodiverse characters is headed to television. The animated show, Carl the Collector, will premiere Thursday. Aimed at children ages 4 to 8, the show follows the adventures of Carl, a raccoon with autism who loves to collect everything from autographs and pet rocks to bottle caps and sweaters, and his friends in Fuzzy Town as they solve problems. Carl's friends include Lotta, a fox with autism who excels at art and music, but is hypersensitive to sounds, smells, and food textures, and Sheldon, an empathetic beaver who helps Carl navigate social situations. There are also Nico and Arugula, twin bunnies with strikingly different personalities, and Forrest, an adventurous, hyperactive, and impulsive squirrel who has a tree nut allergy. Each episode highlights various characters' strengths and struggles. Carl's anxiety is apparent, for example, when he freezes up when Nico takes a tumble in an episode called The Fall. But Carl's eye for detail comes in handy in The Fake Mustache Collection, when he's able to help Nico and Arugula see their differences after the twins become frustrated that no one can distinguish them. Carl the Collector spotlights neurodiverse characters while exploring and celebrating the entire spectrum of humanity, said Zachariah O'Hora, the show's creator and executive producer. The world of Fuzzy Town is designed to be a place where all viewers will see themselves or someone they know in it. We hope Carl and his friends will encourage empathy and understanding, and ultimately show that everyone benefits when we recognize and embrace our differences. In addition to featuring various abilities on screen, the show includes neurodiverse writers, production staff, animators, advisors, and voice talent. Digital content for kids, families, and teachers focused on self-discovery, identity, and encourage empathy will launch later this week alongside the series, which will be available in English and Spanish. Well, that concludes our program. Thanks for joining us for the Disability News, and join us again next time on Sun Sounds of Arizona.